Our second case this morning is United States against Ettinger. Councilman Prince, you may proceed.
May it please the court, Captain Elizabeth Turner, along with Lieutenant Colonel Jonathan Potter, on behalf of the appellant, Private Jerry Ettinger. Appellant was convicted of rape and false official statement after two military judges abused their discretion and erroneously admitted the testimony of TG pursuant to MRE 413 and 414. Two military judges presided in this case, one in the initial stages and motions hearing, and the second in the actual trial. Both judges failed to conduct a proper threshold analysis and MRE 403 balancing test, thereby admitting improper propensity evidence and ultimately prejudicing appellant. As someone of a roadmap, I'm going to start with discussing the issues with the initial military judge, the problem with the adoption of his findings, right factors, and concluding with prejudice. In ruling on the defense motion to altogether preclude TG's testimony, the initial military judge did make some findings of fact and conclusions of law and conducted a 403 balancing test. However, it was done so improperly. Despite a request from the defense that the military judge determine the admissibility and rule on each individual piece of evidence proffered by the government, the military judge simply lumped all the propensity evidence together and determined that the events are similar to those charged, these events being sexual acts with young girls, Joint Appendix 167. The military judge did not make individual findings, thereby making it impossible to parse his ruling or determine which, if any, evidence might have passed a properly conducted balancing test. Additionally, at the time of the judge's ruling, appellant was also charged with one specification of indecent liberties, which involved masturbating in the presence of N.A. It is clear in the written ruling that it was this pending charge that greatly influenced the military judge's balancing test, as he determined that the circumstances of the pose act, if you will, to be strikingly similar, Joint Appendix 168. In the law and analysis portion of the judge's findings, he uses the term similar or strikingly similar a total of six different times. Yet the only clearly identifiable act that he references is that pose act, which ultimately was dismissed subsequent to his findings. Any similarity cited by the military judge left with the dismissal of that charge. What might have been relevant at the time of the initial determination was now outdated rationale and unrepresentative of the actual charge sheet. This significant change should have resulted in a new examination of the propensity evidence and a new ruling by the new judge on the bench. Defense renewed its objection, and the new judge simply adopted the old findings, flatly stating that the evidence would appear to still be admissible.
Didn't the government have to prove the posed situation, though, when they proved the official false statement in regard to that situation? That was the underlying offense, and certainly they dismissed that, but they didn't dismiss, and they went forward with the official false statement in regard to what happened in that offense.
Right.
And they were required then to prove the underlying offense in that.
Precisely. But in referencing that POSE Act, I'm talking about TG's propensity evidence coming in. That was the POSE Act in the propensity evidence that he was saying was quite similar to the charged offense, which was the indecent liberty, which was ultimately dismissed. So while he was still allowing the POSE Act testimony from N.A. to come in to work with that 107 charge, TG's testimony as to the POSE Act should not have come in.
And why not? If they're required to establish that in order to prove the official false statement act.
They would have been required to establish that through N.A., who is what the false official statement was referencing, whether or not that it happened with N.A., not with T.G., Your Honor. It was T.G. that had a POSE Act, and N.A.'s testimony about a POSE Act that was related to the 107
But event. Doesn't N.A. make it more or less likely did it happen with TJ?
I'm
with
sorry,
respect
so
to the
saying
false
it,
statement.
Does that's, it TG make it more likely?
Yeah, ABC, I'm confused. But
Well, TG's testimony would not have been proper to lend credence to a 107 offense. And the reason that TG's pose acts and the propensity evidence should have been kept out was it shouldn't have passed the 403 balancing test, because this was definitely highly prejudicial in light of the fact that there was also a 107 charge being litigated at the time. It was kind of a double layering.
But it is a 107 charge that's not about whether he paid his taxes. It's a 107 charge about the very act in question, in theory.
Well, it is a 107 charge regarding whether or not he lied about something that would qualify under 414. But allowing in propensity evidence, when you look at that list in 414 of what should come in, the charged offense also needs to be an act of child molestation. And a 107 is not.
What about charge one? What's your best argument as to why the propensity evidence is not properly admissible with respect to charge one? And do you treat all of the propensity evidence that was admitted the same, or do you parse it out differently? Is there some evidence that you find more objectionable than others?
Yes,
and if
absolutely.
So, why?
Absolutely, ma'am. And that would be the statement. Do you want me to proceed with the statement?
Okay, and then assuming that we agree with you that the statement was improperly admitted, explain how you're prejudiced by that statement in light of all the other evidence in the case.
Okay.
That's that you have to leave?
Yes, sir. Okay, so I'll go ahead and start with the statement, ma'am. A significant error made by the judges was in allowing the statement made by appellant to TG, the alleged statement, to pass the threshold requirements. Before admitting any evidence under 414, the three threshold requirements have to be looked at. The rule allows an evidence of acts, not statements. The main rule provides an exclusive list of offenses that qualify as offenses of child molestation. That's quoted in Schroeder. TG's testimony that appellant said words to the effect of, if I wanted to see what was going on, I could be a part of it, the day after TG had accidentally walked in on her mother and appellant having sex, simply does not meet the definition of child molestation or sexual assault under MRA 413.
Okay. Why isn't that a solicitation for sex? Or could be construed by the fact finder to be, as he solicited MA for sex before the alleged rape took place.
Attempting to couch that as an attempt or solicitation is really taking it a step too far. That was not even a contemporaneous statement. As evidenced through her own testimony at trial, it was nothing more than a flippant remark made the next day. It was an errant comment. And it was nothing more than that. And stretching it out to attempt to qualify it as something else is a step too far. Additionally, at the time of the motions hearing, at no point in time was any of that offered. There was no discussion. There was not an argument about that being a potential avenue that the government was attempting to proceed down, that that's what they were attempting to do.
Does that bind us, or are we in a position ruling on this type of objection, that we can, if we can find a basis in the record for the admissibility, that's sufficient? What's our standard?
Well, initially, when looking at whether or not the evidence was admitted erroneously, it is an abuse of discretion. But in determining, there's also a de novo review here determining whether or not there was harmless error by looking at the four things.
I'm not talking about harmless error. I'm talking about whether it was error. That is, while we give greater deference when a particular rationale is articulated, does the absence of a rationale preclude us from determining on our own whether there was a basis for admitting the testimony along the lines of the previous questions suggested?
No, Your Honor, but the fact that there was not, that the evidence was not fully evaluated and that a clear reasoning wasn't articulated on the record definitely gets less deference. And here I would argue that there should be no deference because the...
Even if there's no deference, does that preclude us from, on our own, making the determination?
Yeah.
Thank you.
What is there any other... which of the other evidence do you think is not 413, 414 evidence?
Well...
If any.
Our contention with the statement is that basically it failed that initial threshold analysis.
And now we're taking the statement out of the picture, and I'm asking you about the other evidence that was the subject of the motion.
Correct. And I'm only saying that In regard to the other three pieces, we would concede that it absolutely meets that threshold analysis.
So but then why?
Because in looking at the right factors and in applying that constitutional safeguard, we feel that the military judge definitely did not do that balancing appropriately. Conspicuously absent from that first judge's findings was any analysis whatsoever of what factors weighed against admission of the evidence. While he did list out all nine of the factors, and actually the additional Bailey factor, which is similarity of the charged and uncharged misconduct, the analysis was less than meaningful. Specifically, the military judge should have further assessed temporal proximity, strength of proof, frequency of the acts, distraction of the fact finder, probative weight, and the dissimilar nature of the acts. And I can go one by one through those.
Well, let's say that we disagree with you about all those things. How if at all were you prejudiced? Was he prejudiced by the admission of the words, essentially inviting the child to join in? Given all the other evidence in the case?
Well, ultimately, Your Honor, in looking at, in doing that four-part test to determine whether or not the evidence was harmless, this court cannot be confident that the findings and sentence of the members of the court martial were not substantially influenced by the improperly admitted evidence.
Why not? You've got a rape and you've got a false official statement. If it was error to admit it as the false official statement, doesn't the rape bulk so much greater in the calculus of things that there can't really be any prejudice?
No, we would disagree with that contention.
Why?
Because while military judges and counsel are definitely skilled at deciphering evidence and drawing bright line rules and standards, we can't be certain that the panel effectively categorized that or separated it out or didn't somehow apply that to their findings.
Counsel, could you let's pursue that a little bit further. If there had been a conviction on the false official statement and a conviction on rape, then I would understand your argument that it would be hard to sort out.
Your Honor, there was a conviction on the false official statement.
Yeah, I'm saying in light of the conviction on the false official statement and the conviction on rape, what is it that you are having us want to sort out in terms of prejudice and not prejudice in terms of that particular statement?
Well, I believe in looking at the four-part test, when we're talking about the strength of the government's case, it was apparent that when the panel was called upon to rely on the statements of N.A., that they found them to be less than credible. And our contention is that it's impossible to parse out what they would have considered when all four of those pieces of evidence came before them. This is dangerous testimony. This is dangerous ground in the sense that it's hard to imagine anything more inflammatory to a panel or damaging to accused than being labeled a child molester via uncharged misconduct. And I see the point of, well, in specifically this statement, how did that affect you?
Right.
But it's absolutely the introduction of all of it, sans balancing test, that we find to be prejudicial.
I mean, one of the things that you complain about is the failure to discuss the temporal aspects between the two events. But here we're talking about it's a four-year difference, and he was dealt both times. What was it that you wanted him to discuss?
Well, temporal proximity should be more than just a mathematical calculation of when the acts occurred. And the military judge did find that they were between 4 and 7 years of one another, but it was more than 10 years before trial. And we think that temporal proximity issue is linked directly with the strength of proof, specifically with the fact that the police report was not available whatsoever, and the fact that there had been a recantation. We're dealing with something 10 years prior that had been recanted, and that now no piece of evidence is available to either party, which could have actually been helpful to the government and to the defense.
Was TG cross-examined on that point, the recantation?
Yes, ma'am.
So that evidence was available to the members?
Of the recantation itself, yes. But the police report was not available to the defense.
She didn't disagree that she recanted, did she?
No, Your Honor. She did, in fact, admit that she recanted.
Is the temporal issue based on number of years alone, or does that vary depending upon the circumstances of an individual case?
Sir, it absolutely varies upon the individual circumstances of the case.
So the fact that it was the number of years that were involved in this case, that in and of itself?
No, not in and of itself, but in the listing of the factors that we have listed, that I have listed previously. We do think the accumulation of the military judge failing to look at all of those definitely prejudiced the appellant in this case. In light of the strong legislative judgment in favor of admission, the procedural safeguards here must be fiercely maintained. And the individual charged with that duty is the military judge. And a 403 balancing has got to be more than a block check. And that's precisely what it was in this case.
Do you have a case that stands for the proposition that the second military judge erred by saying that he reviewed the findings of the first military judge and agreed with them? Or basically one saying that whenever a military judge is replaced by a subsequent military judge, that they have to reinvent the wheel and redo all motions and redo findings of fact and motions of law?
No, ma'am, I can't point. I don't have a case to cite to you specifically. However, we're not contending that there's never a point in time that an adoption can be made and in fact be appropriate and fine. That's not our contention whatsoever. But the fact that the military judge made that adoption when the charge sheet had changed significantly and what he was adopting were findings based on a charge sheet that actually included an indecent liberty. And the fact that replete through the law and analysis of his findings, the only identifiable act that he's discussing is the POSE Act, which is in fact what encompassed the indecent liberties charge. So the fact that subsequent military judge adopted outdated rationale, he was asked, the motion was renewed, and asked to please reconsider each piece of propensity evidence based on the significant change, he declined.
Counsel, generally in these cases we say that we're not going to give deference to the military judge's decision if he has not given an analysis and an explanation. In this case, certainly the first military judge gave a pretty detailed analysis, although I understand you don't agree with it. Should we give any deference at all to that decision?
To the initial decision,
in light of your argument that the facts had changed.
Ultimately, I think what's important is what was happening at the time of trial, which would be the adoption, and I would say that the subsequent military judge would get no deference. However, if we were only dealing with the initial military judge, he definitely listed the factors and made an attempt, although I don't find them to be thorough. One of the things...
Well, that's not my question. We're not only dealing with the first military judge, we're dealing with both. And how much deference do we give?
Less deference, sir.
Less deference.
Less deference.
Because of the factual change, the charge change.
Yes, sir.
Now, another question. I'll try to get the conviction straight here. In terms of both the convictions in this case, the government has argued no plain error here. How do you respond to the plain error argument?
Well, the admission of a statement, I think, is obvious and plain error because it does not meet that threshold analysis. So in that sense, that part of the analysis of the propensity evidence is clearly plain error.
It doesn't meet the threshold with respect to attempt and would clearly not meet that threshold, is what you're saying?
Yes, sir.
Remember, you have to deal with 6 and not just 1 through 5.
Yes, sir.
And why is it plain and obvious that you have to leave or be part of this does not constitute an attempt to engage in child molestation?
Well, the testimony at trial was that statement was made the next day. And in actually evaluating TG's testimony, it's clear that at no point in time was that anything, could that be couched as an act of solicitation? She in her own testimony, she was describing it as nothing more than a flippant remark.
Well, but that's for the judge initially to determine in terms of the admissibility and then for the fact finder ultimately. Why does that constitute plain error if it's an ambiguous matter that could be interpreted in various ways?
While that might be, while it might be open to interpretation, sir, that interpretation was not offered by the government or argued or a part of any of the findings or analysis. We think that looking at the rule,
I'm talking about plain error here. I'm not talking about deference. Because if we're talking about plain error, then we're going to assume there's an error.
An error.
Why is it plain?
Because in looking at the actual substance of 414, that is clearly not listed. That is an exclusive list, and it's not listed within 414. And although we did not cite it, I believe it is embedded in one of the cases, but when looking at 414, it should be a fundamental part of statutory interpretation is in looking at it with the understanding that Congress has said what they mean and mean what they say. And that was not indecent language, was absolutely not included in 414.
If it were clearly a solicitation for sex, would you have a different position if the language were different?
If it were a clear solicitation for sex, I definitely think that there would be a better argument in saying that it could fall under 414. I don't believe that with the facts of this case that would qualify.
Counsel, I believe we've run over your time here, and you'll have an opportunity on rebuttal unless I've interrupted you in thought there.
Yes, sir.
Counsel for the government.
May it please the court, my name is Captain Sarah Rykowski, and along with Lieutenant Colonel Martha Foss, I represent the United States government in this matter. Neither of the military judges in this case erred in admitting the testimony of TG pursuant to Military Rule of Evidence 413 and 414. The first military judge properly analyzed each act according to the Military Rule of Evidence 403 test of United States versus White, and the second military judge properly reviewed that analysis and, based on the changed circumstances of the case, properly ratified it. Appellant waived any objection to the differences between TG's testimony for the purposes of the motion and her testimony at trial. Wherefore, the government respectfully requests this honorable court affirm the findings and sentence as affirmed by the Army courts. In this case, the standard of review is for abuse of discretion is that it will only reverse where the challenged action is arbitrary, fanciful, clearly unreasonable, or clearly erroneous, and the military judge's actions in this case were in none of those categories. In this case, the military judge laid out his findings with regard to Military Rule of Evidence 403, specifically in his findings addressing each of the right factors and also the similarity factor from United States versus Bailey.
But with respect to the second military judge, in light of the government having dismissed the indecent liberties charge, do you disagree that it would have been a better practice for the second military judge to do a little bit more than just ratify without any explanation and you mouth the words, "I conducted a 403 balancing test"?
Your Honor, it would appear from the military judge's analysis on that page, what he did place on the record is he did apply the changed circumstances. He did at least place some of his analysis. It's very brief, but there is analysis there. So the government's position is that, albeit brief, he did address the changed circumstances, and pursuant to the fact that the rape charge and the subject matter of the false official statement charge included acts of sexual molestation.
If let's say the rape charge was off the table also, you're not suggesting that the 414 evidence would be admissible in light of the false official statement charges just because they involve sexual acts with the children, do you?
No, Your Honor.
Well, why didn't the dismissal of charge 3 change the analysis of 412 and 413?
413 and 414.
Excuse me, 413 and 414.
It didn't, Your Honor, because there still remained the first military judge made a very thorough analysis. The government disagrees with appellant's characterization of it as incomplete or improper or erroneous. He did make that complete analysis, that detailed analysis, and then at the end of the day, there's still a rape charge on the table. There's still, the acts against N.A. are still before the court with regard to that sexual assault, and acts of sexual or child molestation can come in to prove offenses of sexual assault, because an offense of sexual assault against a child is per se an act of sexual or child molestation. If I'm answering your question, Your Honor, I'm not sure that I understood it.
Yeah, that's fine. Thank you.
In this case, the military judge did address the temporal difference between the offenses against TG and the offenses against N.A. And he found that they weighed on the side of admissibility. Although they were not simultaneous, his decision is supported by case law in that area, where in United States versus Durrell, the acts occurred 7 to 10 years earlier, and in United States versus Bailey, 3 to 5 years, and then for another victim, 10 years earlier. So in fact, the military judge properly addressed the temporal factor with respect to the other factors that's related to those, in that the difference, the temporal difference in this case, had to do with the fact that he only abused each victim when he was in a relationship with the victim's mother.
Now, counsel, some of these factors are matters that you're drawing out of the record rather than matters that were articulated by the second judge. Are we in a position here where we're going to give little deference, but then the government's going to ask us to make our own analysis of the record? How much deference is involved in the situation we find ourselves with the second military judge?
With the second military judge, he did place some very limited analysis on the record, so he is entitled to some deference, Your Honor. However, you can, under United States versus Mann, review the record on your own.
Okay, so let's start from that perspective, and we're reviewing it on our own. What's the government's position as to why this should be sustained?
Reviewing the record on your, as far as the evidence that was presented at the trial, Your Honor?
That's all we got before us, yeah. Okay.
If you look at the evidence presented at the trial, one, the government's analysis includes that first military judge's ruling for the purposes of the motion in limine was proper. So at the point, once we're at the trial, if I'm understanding Your Honor's question, they were, in fact, the evidence presented did, in fact, satisfy all of those factors. And if, at the point, once we're at the trial, anything that came in, those changes in the testimony that were different, where he masturbated, she added testimony that he masturbated during the incident in the bathroom, and then she subtracted it from the incident where she was on all fours. Those differences fall in the realm of plain error, Your Honor. If the middle, at the point, once evidence is presented at trial that potentially runs into 413 or 414, or in this case now we're operating on the prior motion in limine, if there are any differences, the military judge has no duty to sua sponte stop and say, I need to do another ruling. It is up to the defense counsel, pursuant to United States versus Johnson, to raise an objection, as he did in several instances. So the fact that he did not, with respect to these changes, again, he forfeited his right to object. I'm not sure that I'm understanding your question, Your Honor, if I'm sort of looking at the record.
Right. I think what you're giving is a plain error analysis. My question is there error here? That is, if we look at the evidence as presented at trial from the perspective of the second judge, the first question before we get to plain error, is there error? And there, let's assume we're going to give the military judge no deference at that point. So I think the government's making that argument, but I wasn't clear from your brief what evidence you're relying on for the no error proposition. I understand your plain error and your harmless error argument, and I understand your argument based on the first judge's ruling. But when we're talking about the second, first step in a plain error analysis is to determine whether there's error. So what is the government's argument as to why there was no error for the second judge in this case?
The second judge did review, as he stated on the record, he reviewed the first military judge's analysis. of both the offenses listed and the analysis application of the right factors, and he ratified them. His duty at the point, there was no error in his ratifying it, in his decision to allow them in at that point, because all of the offenses in the government's meet the requirements of 413 and 414, those threshold factors, besides the fact that the government, the defense never raised an objection to application of those factors or those offenses qualifying under those factors. If I'm so...
Well, you're now, again, you're discussing waiver and plain error. I'm trying to figure out if we're going to look at the record itself, what makes the second judge's ruling a proper ruling as to the question of whether this testimony was admissible for that the purpose under which it was entered, irrespective of what the defense did. This is the government's offering this testimony. The judge, at this point, we're going to have a question of whether he committed plain error or not. And then the first question of plain error analysis is, was there error? So
there was none.
We'll later get to the question of whether the defense objected and waived and what we can do, whether it was harmful error. But what's the error?
Yes, Your Honor. There is no error in this case because all of the offenses from a review of the record, all of the offenses, all of those instances testified to by TG meets the requirements of 413 and 414. And the purpose of those rules is to provide notice to the defense of the government's intention to bring in that evidence, to give the defense an opportunity to prepare and to cross-examine on those, in essence, challenge and rebut those offenses. In that case, the military judge provided at trial the opportunity, defense had the opportunity to prepare and did so, did have the opportunity to prepare cross-examination of TG and did cross-examine TG. So under United States versus NJD, the government, the military judge has satisfied his duty with respect to the admission of that evidence. Once it comes in, if there are any changes, he needs to be tracking the ruling for the motion in limine. If there are any changes, he needs to, or it's up to the appellant to object. But he held at trial, it's very clear from the record, that he held the government to the limited portions of TG's testimony that he admitted for the purposes of the motion in limine. And he signaled to the defense that he intended to continue during the trial, anytime any of that evidence came up, to hold the government to the limits of that stipulated testimony for the purposes of the motion. I'm not sure, again, still.
I think your answer is a procedural answer rather than an answer directly to the evidence. It sounds to me like the government's position is once the military judge rules on the motion in limine, and once all the judge has to do is to make sure that the testimony stays within the boundaries of that motion in limine, irrespective of what other changes may take place with respect to the charges and the evidence in the case.
And
is that the government's position?
Somewhat, Your Honor. I mean, I'm still not sure if I'm understanding your question, if we're completely disregarding the analysis. I mean, obviously he, as the new judge, did review, as he was asked to, he reviewed the military judge's ruling, that substantive analysis of those offenses and their qualifications under 413 and 414. So he did do that, and that is his duty. But then he has a
procedure. And he has no duty beyond that?
He has a duty at the trial to also, as he said, he gave limiting instructions, limiting the focus of, limiting the panel's consideration of that testimony to the offenses to which it was relevant. That is, the false official statement, that because of the subject matter, the false official statement that did relate to an offense of child molestation. His instruction specifically limits consideration of TG's testimony to those offenses which qualify as offenses of child molestation. And the military judge is presumed to know the law, is presumed to instruct correctly. He did so in this case. Therefore, we do know what the panel did. They properly considered the evidence pursuant to the military judge's instructions, answering that question. Again, Your Honor, I want to make sure that I'm putting you...
I'm finished, thank you.
Thank you.
I just wanted to clarify, the false statements are offenses of child molestation, or the evidence is being used on any matter to which it is relevant?
Yes, Your Honor. The subject matter, the
one
fact...
One or the other?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
It was a disjunctive presentation, and you said yes.
I apologize, Your Honor.
That's okay. Why is it in on the false statements?
It is because the factual basis of that false official statement concerned an offense of child molestation.
And therefore, the evidence is being considered for its bearing on any matter to which it is relevant, or therefore, a false statement about child molestation is, in fact, an offense of child molestation?
No, it's simply that they can consider it for this specific, the factual basis portion of that offense. They cannot, and they were never instructed that they could find that he committed these offenses of other child molestation. Therefore, he's a child molester. Therefore, he lies about everything. They were not instructed that they could go that far. This evidence was not used in any way, shape, or form in terms of propensity as applied to that false official statement charge.
Do I understand that you agree with the appellant that the judge's instructions open the door to all the offenses regarding this evidence?
They were permitted, they were instructed that they could use...
This is a separate question, by the way.
I'm sorry.
Great. New question.
Okay.
Sorry, confused you.
We do not agree that they were permitted to consider this evidence for absolutely all of the charges on the table, Your Honor, all of the charges before the panel. They were specifically instructed by the military judge that they could consider the evidence of such other acts of child molestation for their tendency, if any, to show appellant's propensity to engage in child molestation, as well as their tendency, if any, to identify appellant as the person who committed the offense alleged in charge one, that is, the rape, to prove a plan of or design of appellant to molest N.A. and to determine whether N.A. had a motive to commit these offenses. So it's a very limited instruction. It is not that
so
they
is
are...
Is it the government's view, then, that that didn't even pertain to the false statements, or did?
If they...
Or is that for the members to figure out?
If they are allowed to consider the evidence of child molestation against TG for the offenses of child molestation, evidence of child molestation against N.A.
Doesn't 414A seems to say that once there's a child molestation charge, that triggers the use of this kind of evidence on any matter to which it is relevant?
Yes, Your Honor.
Which does not seem limited to the child molestation charge.
Exactly, Your Honor, and that's why it's admissible.
But this seems to be at odds with what you just said.
You are correct, Your Honor, and that is what I was trying to communicate, and I was not communicating it very coherently, so I do apologize. But in this case, it is admissible. There is a strong congressional intent that this type of evidence come in these circumstances.
So it can come in on an offense which is not itself a child molestation offense, as long as it's relevant.
Yes, Your Honor. And it is relevant in this case to the
false statement. Well, it's not only relevant, it's the gravamen of the offense.
Yes, Your Honor. It is the gravamen of the offense. In this case, appellant was not prejudiced, has a duty to show prejudice. Assuming there was error, appellant has a duty to show prejudice and has not done so.
Okay. Yeah. We've been talking about waiver and, okay, is it waiver or is it forfeiture? And if so, what's waived or forfeited?
Sir, in this case, it's forfeiture.
Okay. And what is forfeited?
Forfeiture is, in essence, there are only specific areas where you have to affirmatively waive. In this case, because he simply failed to do anything at all, he forfeited.
Forfeited what?
His right to object, his right to raise this as an error on appeal.
And therefore, it is or is not subject to plain error analysis?
There are several layers of analysis in this case, Your Honor. At this point, if we're looking at whether that initial statement, the attempt or solicitation of TG for sexual activity, if we're looking at that, you start with the plain error analysis and move on. And then you move to the harmless error. If any of the evidence came in that should not have come in, if this court determines the military judge error, then we're looking at the harmless error test, which is the strength of the government's case, the weakness of the, or the strength of the defense case, the materiality and the quality of the evidence in this in question. And in this case, the government's position is that there was no prejudice. The appellant has failed to show it, and therefore, even if there was an error in this case, it was harmless. If there are no further questions, may I briefly conclude?
And we gave the defense a little bit more time, so you can have a little bit more, but I think you've got time within the amount remaining. So please proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. In this case, the military judge did not err in admitting the testimony of TG pursuant to 413 or 414. The military judge, both military judges, properly analyzed each act according to the military rule of evidence 403 test of United States versus Wright. Any error by the military judges in this case was either plain or harmless. Wherefore, the government respectfully requests that this honorable court affirm the findings and sentence as by the honorable court.
Thank you, counsel. Does the defense have rebuttal?
Could you address the question I asked?
You may take the podium.
The government, as to the construction of 413 and 414, in other words, does the presence of a spec of a charge alleging in the 414 case child molestation trigger basically that this stuff can come in on any matter to which it is relevant, or is there some limitation to it that doesn't appear in the text of the rule?
No, the rule is limited to the text in the sense that within that threshold analysis, there has to be, the appellant has to be charged with an act that qualifies.
Right, but he is charged.
Right.
Does that, that pulls the trigger.
Right, but it does not make it, it does not allow it to then be used for anything and everything. I mean, ultimately.
Well, there's a relevancy question, but I mean, assuming it's relevant, and that gets you back 401 and all that. But,
well, I
go
think
ahead.
That's where it would hinge, would be on the 401 and the 402 analysis.
Well, how is this not relevant to the false official statement since it's the gravamen of the offense?
But propensity evidence is not designed to get to the gravamen of an offense that's not listed within 414.
Thank you.
So your argument is that under no circumstances can a false official statement charge qualify for 414 admissibility. Is that per se? Is that your argument?
Yes, sir. Yeah. Our contention is that because of the dangerous nature of this testimony, that those procedural safeguards must be fiercely maintained, and it is
based
not designed.
Based on 403 or based on 414?
414 through the lens of 403, but that it is not designed to be used for anything and everything. That's our contention.
Just to clarify that, are you arguing that what about if we don't take 403 into account? Does 414 itself allow for, on its face, the ever circumstance in which a false official statement in which the underlying act is one of the acts listed in 414?
No, sir. I would say with the plain language of the rule, specifically its title, similar crimes. Sorry, I'm sorry to be down.
But what if a similar crime is one of the charges and the 107 charge is another charge, which is the situation that we have here? So it comes in tied to the rape charge. Are you suggesting that the text of 414 doesn't permit it to also be considered for any matter to which it's relevant, which in this case would be false official statements where the government has to prove that the underlying acts, i.e. sexual behavior with the child, happened?
In this particular case, ma'am, it absolutely in no way should that propensity evidence have been allowed in. With the facts of this case, N.A. was testifying through propensity evidence as the ultimate part of that charge. So admitting TG's testimony was definitely error.
And is that based on 414 or 403? With respect to
I would say both.
And to clarify, then your answer to the question that you just got was yes, that there are circumstances when there are two charges, that the evidence that's admissible on one of the charges listed in 414 can also come into play with respect to one of the charges that's not listed if the underlying facts, as in a false official statement, are the same as the 414 listed charge. Your argument, I understand your 403 argument why it doesn't apply here, but are you arguing that it can never be used when you have the two offenses?
I do not think that that was the legislative intent, and so no, I do not feel that it should be used.
Okay, thank you. Thank both parties for your submission and argument. The case is now submitted, and the court will be in recess until 9:30 a.m. on October 13th.